Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Jesse Pooji. I love stories of transformations. I love stories where people become something new, and this is one of those stories. At one point, I actually have tears in my eyes. You could check that out at the YouTube version of the podcast, youtube.com/Danny Miranda. And that's because Jesse's story, his lightness, his energy comes through so strongly in this podcast. And so we spoke about his light, how he's become more self-aware, the things that he's done to transform himself and transform his relationship with himself and the people around him. We talked about the little behavioral shifts that he's made in his own life, how his relationship with his wife has changed because he's discovered his purpose. I mean, all of this stuff is so near and dear to my heart. And it's a really, really valuable conversation that I personally will revisit myself. If you enjoyed this conversation, let me know on Twitter, twitter.com/HeyDannyMiranda. I look forward to hearing from you. But until then, this is my conversation with Jesse Pooji.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Jesse, thank you for coming on the podcast. And I want to just break the third wall here for a second for the listener and be transparent that we took a minute of time to just be present. And I love that. So I want to ask about that. Why do you do that? And when did you start doing practices like that?
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about, we could go down a really far rat hole here, but I started doing coaching in 2017. And, you know, one of the many lessons of becoming more self-aware, it's not just about self-awareness broadly, where 2 days later you look back and go, oh yeah, man, I wasn't at my best then, I wasn't a jerk, but really developing that self-awareness in the moment, and getting present in the moment and knowing when you're not present. And so that's something I've been cultivating for, I guess, 4 years now. And, you know, I was running a little bit late to the call, as you know, and that's kind of a sign to me. It's almost like a hack. I'm like, oh, I know I'm not present because I was rushing off something else to get onto this call. And, you know, the concept of being present, when you're not present, you're oftentimes reacting in a state of threat. So you're, you know, there's something you feel like is impacting. Oh, I was late. Oh my God, Danny upset with me. Am I, you know, and being present, there's just, you're realizing there's no real threats. And one of the most, again, another hack is like just box breathing for a minute, kind of, you know, 4 seconds in, holding for 4 seconds, 4 seconds out, which my coach taught me as a way of getting present. But the crazy thing is it actually affects your blood chemistry. And that's actually what's happening is when you're in a state of threat, there's a little bit of adrenaline comes in your blood, which is a natural survival habit. And this is a really fun, open learning conversation where I don't need that survival instinct in this moment. But if I didn't take time to switch my blood chemistry, then I might forget to say the thing I want to say. I might respond, you know, react, be too reactive in the conversation, whatever it might be. I wouldn't be who I want to be and being present. And so that's sort of a long answer to a short question, but yeah, I've been doing it for several years and I'm not perfect. Nobody is, but you know, in the moments where I really know I'm not present and I would like to be present, I do that.
What's the biggest difference between Jesse from 2016 and Jesse today?
Oh man, I feel like a whole podcast topic. What is the biggest difference? It might just be that. It might be what you just witnessed. It might be the ability to know when I'm feeling threat or when I'm constricted or I'm not open, and to be able to actually stop myself in the moment to make that switch. I mean, in a nutshell, I think, you know, I'm better at communicating than I was then. Maybe a higher level version is like, I think I spent most of my time operating out of fear prior, you know, in 2016 and prior. And now I spend significantly less time operating out of fear. I mean, I still spend a lot of time operating out of fear, but a lot more time in my genius and things that I think learning mode and being open, wanting to help people, just things that are not about fear.
Yeah, you bring up genius mode. And I remember looking at your profile, looking at you when you brought up Gay Hendrix. And I said, wow, this is interesting. He's an entrepreneur, but he's also interested in conscious living and conscious leadership. And I was like, this is such a fascinating topic to explore. And I just want to learn about the early days of getting to know conscious leadership and why you decided to go in the first place down that direction. And then take us through that journey if you could.
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, I started a business in 2010. And I grew up in a pretty traditional immigrant, you know, first generation household. My dad, you know, he moved over from India when he was 17 with a dollar in his pocket. You know, he worked his ass off his whole life. He provided amazingly well for us, you know, gave us every advantage we could ever ask for, not the least of which was just being born in this country. But then, you know, middle class plus upbringing. He was always an entrepreneur and you know, learned a lot from him around the way he operated. You know, and I'd say a lot of it was like operating to survive and operating to kind of make it happen. And that being kind of the core foundation, I think, especially for Indian Americans with immigrants, there's just certain values. You work really hard, you know, you're constantly trying to push yourself to the next level. You know, the joke in Indian culture is like, if you get a 97 on a test, your parent asks you, well, what happened to the other 3 points? And so I think that was sort of the way I was raised, and it led me to great achievements. I got into great university and, you know, worked at very fancy companies and, you know, ran Ambush for the first 5 or 6 years. And we ran hard and we had a lot of success. And, you know, at some point we felt like by 2014, let's say we started in 2010, by 2014, we were like, we're not having that much fun. We're not really enjoying this. We just want to be done with it. And it was sort of like the classic entrepreneur thing of like, wait a second, your dream is a nightmare. And we were like, that's strange. And in 2015, we had a partial exit of the business. My daughter was born in April of 2017. And, you know, we thought we were going to partially exit the business and sell the rest of it. And that started to become less likely. And I kind of just found myself in this rut, you know, and I wasn't like depressed or anything like that. But I would wake up in the morning, cancel my morning meetings, show up to work at 11, leave at 3. Like, I just didn't really want to be there. My wife was like, the first time she's ever seen me this way for several months. And I, you know, the company that invested in us is this awesome business called Red Ventures, and the CEO and founder there is a guy named Rick Elias, and he's famous for one of many things, but one of them was he was in that Sully flight. He was in the flight that landed in the Hudson. Wow. And he has a TED talk about it, and so he's had his moment. You know, he talks very like he almost died. He thought he was going to die, and it really changed his life in many different ways. He's very present. There's a lot of work he's done too. And, you know, him and I have a great relationship, and I called him one day and I said, I feel stuck, you know, and I don't know what to do, don't know where to go. And he, you know, in a very older brother, uncle-ish kind of way, he sort of said, you know, he said, you're a lucky MF-er. Like, and he started saying, you know, you have two beautiful children. You've made more money than, you know, 99% of people your age. You run your own business. And he really started kind of giving me that perspective. But the takeaway from it was there's probably some inner work to be done that you're missing that you're not seeing that. And he really encouraged me to get coaching. He said, go hire a coach, talk to them about your things and see what you learn. And there's probably a lot of, and he also, the other thing he encouraged me to do to his credit was make Ambush the purpose of it is literally your personal growth and development, and encourage your employees to do the same, like really hone that as a, you know, calling card. That's what you're doing every day. So we went and hired a coach. You know, I still work with him. His name's Dave Cashin. He's like, you know, into the conscious leadership stuff. And, you know, I'd say that the first big aha moment was probably in the first week or two of doing it. And he started explaining the 5 types of motivators to us, you know, that the conscious leadership group talks about. And these are all, you know, I think all of them are different-ish paths to generally the same thing, including religion and other stuff. And he said, you know, there's fear, there's extrinsic, there's intrinsic, there's play genius, and then there's like empathy or love. And you know, the fear is obvious. Extrinsic is like money and titles and status. Intrinsic is kind of beating your own score. Play genius is just sort of like you have fun doing it, so you want to do more of it. And then empathy, love. That one's, people get confused sometimes. Like, the way I think about it is, you know, typically a passionate restaurateur is not actually passionate about food, although they may be a great chef, but they're truly passionate about the human experience of breaking bread and tasting delicious. So it's like, it's the human experience that motivates. Like Steve Jobs, I don't think he was actually that passionate about technology or like computers. He was very passionate about the human experience of interacting with that device and what it can do for your life. And so he's like, oh, those are the five. And you know, fear is very effective. It's not bad or good. It's just, it's highly effective. If I put a gun to your head, you'll run as fast as you've ever run, but it's non-renewable. Because once you stop feeling the fear, you have to either create more fear for yourself or find, you know, you have to find something else to tap into. It also tends to leave a negative residue on you and others around you. And then all the way up, you know, through the thing is like doing something to the human experience tends to be very renewable and very powerful. So does genius. Like when you're just doing the things that you love, that tends to be really, and that we had never, I'd never heard that at that point. And he was like, I have like bad news. You guys have basically been motivating yourself with fear all this time. And now you've actually had some success and you're kind of lost because that's no longer the thing that works for you anymore. And I remember also thinking at that time, like, all these different answers, like maybe I'm just tired, maybe I don't like marketing and customer acquisition, like maybe Facebook is not, you know, I had all these answers for what might not be, but I didn't have this answer of, no, maybe I'd just been using fear for a long time and I'd done well and, you know, had a partial exit and it didn't satisfy me quite the way it would. So that was sort of the beginning of the journey for me, which was around 2017. And then obviously could talk much more about a bunch of different things, but that was kind of the story for what led me to then asking the question of, what else could motivate me? What else is there? And that's been kind of quite a life journey for me.
If I'm correct, you still were working on Ambush for another 3 years after that, or maybe you still work today
on Ambush? Do, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you take something that was once fear-based and continue to do it, but move up the scale?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the interesting things about that scale is that when people first hear it, they think of it as a broad generalization. Oh, I'm fear motivated. Oh no, I'm intrinsic motivated. Like, and the truth is, we use all five of those every day, you know, and every minute or every hour, right? And that's part of the idea of getting present. And so, part of it is like just noticing when you're what. And that was like, I was joking for the first year. People talk to me about coaching. I said for the first year, my coach was like Mr. Miyagi. Like he was just like, just notice, just start noticing. Like there was far less specific work or tasks. It was just like, notice when are you feeling, when did your chest get tight? When do your shoulders get tight? When do you feel light and effervescent, and start trying to correlate those different things? Cause the truth was we were using all five of those things every day. And so that's part of the answer. The second part of the answer is this another paradigm from the CLG guys, which is context versus content, right? And so content is Facebook ads or healthcare startup or nonprofit. It's the what happens. The context is from where are you doing that? And the craziest thing about all this work is that you can do it. You can do anything. You can run a cancer curing startup from a place of fear and wanting status and money. You can also run the cancer from a place of wanting to cure patients for cancer. And by the way, in the same day, you could do them for different contexts. It could be different contexts. So a lot of it was thinking about what I truly enjoyed about running a business and building a business and what my sort of like zones of genius and what I really loved. And that took a couple, like a year plus of sort of deconstructing and then reframing the work I did through that lens. And I can talk more about that, but the crazy thing was I had a lot of people who worked with me before and after this, and one of the most telling pieces of feedback they would give me, they'd say, you know, it's funny, Jesse, you don't say anything different. You're just as deep into the numbers and as rigorous as you've ever been, and you have high expectations for us. All the things are the same, but I feel so different when I talk to you now. And like it was like my head was exploding because it was like I was just relating to the same set of numbers and problems in business from just a different position and a different context. And so I think I was very skeptical of this concept, by the way. I should say that, like, it for the first year of understanding it, I was like, this is bullshit. Like, no, it's like, if I was working on a problem more exciting, I'd be more excited. If I was, and I really was like, what are you talking about? And now I'm like very much a true believer in it because I've sort of experienced it.
Dude, I've tears in my eyes because there's a sense of lightness that I heard on hearing you in Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast. And I was like, wow, this guy's full of light and full of love. And there's a sense of lightness I feel in this moment from hearing you speak. And I'm sure people listening, if they really feel it inside their body, they will feel that from hearing you speak right now. And it's real. And how did you get over that hump? Or what would you recommend to somebody who is like, wow, that sounds kind of interesting, but I don't know if I'm ready to do something like that myself?
Yeah. I think one thing is, and as I've learned this stuff, I've made a pretty classic mistake, which is like, it's so life changing that I've like, oh, my brothers and this and like,
proselytize.
And one of the, yeah, totally. And one of the big lessons obviously is that there has to be an openness to it and a desire for it before it can turn into otherwise, in many ways, it's the opposite. It's very off putting. And I still make that mistake. I think like the stuff that Dave did that was really effective for me was the little stuff. And I think once I started believing the little stuff, then I started believing the bigger stuff, if that kind of makes sense. So like
what?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple examples. Like, you know, one was, I'd say, you know, I want to be more compassionate in a meeting. I want to just show up and be more empathetic. I'm not an empathetic person, right? I wasn't raised with empathy. And of course, Dave will first correct me and say, well, up until now, because you're not just categorizing yourself as something, which I've now do, you know, I think that's very true. It's very limiting to say, I'm not, you know, up until now, I would like to be more empathetic in a meeting. And, you know, that seems like, oh my God, that's a huge task. And he said, you know, when you believe in the context versus content and the willingness, he goes, he had me like write down, you know, three things on index cards, be empathetic, be inspirational on a different one. And, be learning oriented. I'm making those up. And he's like, just keep them in your back pocket. Before the meeting, just look at that word, just like that little second of intention setting to being that thing. And then see how you show up and see if you feel like you're, and that was very effective. Just this little piece of intentionality. And I was like, oh, wow. So I think there was something like that that became very, that's a small example, like, you know, box press, just breathing before a meeting and getting present and realizing you're showing up in different ways. So there's a bunch of these little behavioral shifts that I think is probably where I'd tell people to start. You know, another one that I recommend that I really enjoy is like, you know, some sort of morning 2-3 minute journal, a few things you're grateful for, like that sort of stuff. Just, it really started to have compounding effects on me over time. So those tend to be like the smaller things that, I usually recommend folks to start with. Because if you believe that you can do the same thing from a different context and you actually experience it, then it becomes a much easier sell. Right. Yeah. And so it's like, if I ran a meeting, our numbers are down. The old Jesse, the 2016 Jesse, like without knowing it unconsciously is freaked the fuck out. Right. I'm scared. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm scared. I'm like this. And I'm like, why, what, you know, what were the numbers there and how does that break down and what goes on? And again, like, and then the new Jesse is like, well, hold on. This is a really great opportunity to teach Danny something and make him a better business person. That's how I'm going to relate to this problem now. By the way, the questions are exactly the same. How do you break down that number? What do we think about this? But again, the way I showed up was so different in those things. And so you start to see that. We started to see organizational culture things happening, scores improving, just like the whole, it became a good and, you know, positive, meaningful feedback loop for us.
You talk about professionally how it's transformative. What about personally? What are those closest to you? What were they saying while new Jesse was coming about?
When they weren't irritated with me for trying to tell them they should also get coaching and stuff. I think my wife, it really had a big impact on my marriage and my parenting. And in so many different ways, you know, I think like the, I mean, one simple in my marriage is like, I realize, and I'm far from perfect, but like how oftentimes I was not present with my wife, and not on my phone way even. Like, I think that's what people typically mean, not present, is like, oh, you're on your phone, but I think of it now, obviously, as just like, am I there with her fully kind of taking in the moment of that stuff? And I think, therefore, how do I respond to her? How do I react? All those different things. I think that's one. You know, another really strong example that kind of comes from the conscious leadership stuff is one of the, I think, sixth or seventh is like having clear agreements. And so this one really, you know, kind of changed my marriage. And what I realized after going through this, I was like, wow, we never have any clear agreements with each other. Right. And like the story I was telling about this was like, we had, my son was pretty young, and, you know, it was like Friday, it was a day like today, Friday. And we were going on a date night, and I came home, and I had started doing conscious leadership stuff. So I was just in the beginning parts of it, so I knew a little bit. And my wife was like, hey, you know, I was like, okay, cool, what's up, you know? And she's like, oh, the babysitter's coming at 8 o'clock today. And our son usually sleeps at 8:30. So I get home at like 7:30, and I go hang out with our son. And, you know, babysitter shows up at 8 o'clock. She pops her head in, she goes, oh, the babysitter's here. I'm like, okay, cool. Playing with my son, you know, play with him till like 8:20. 8:25 or something like that. And well, we had a reservation at 8:30, but it's 10 minutes away. So I was like, get in the car around 8:20. I'm like, we're perfectly on time. And she's pissed. And I'm like, what happened? Like, what's up? She's like, I told you the babysitter was 8 o'clock. And I was like, that's cool. Like, I didn't know that, like, that meant that you wanted to leave at 8, like, whatever, she was hungry or whatever it was. Right. But it was a tiny little example where, like, you know, I'm not hyper intuitive, where I have up until now, I haven't been hyper intuitive as a person, and realized she meant something different. And it became a tiff, and it wasn't a huge tiff or anything, but like, it was a tiff. She was annoyed. She was frustrated because she was hungry, and she thought she was saying to me, we were leaving at 8 o'clock, and I did not hear that. And it was 8:20. So we were leaving 20 minutes later than she thought she had told me. And so, like, of course she's upset about that. Why wouldn't you be, right? If it's just like totally flippantly been disregarded for 20 minutes, when you're hungry, right? That's the feeling. That's the story, right, that she had told herself. And so we just got really good at saying, what do you want me to do by when? Like, what needs to get done by when? And being really clear about it. And then, like, trying to be more in integrity with each other around the promises that we have made to each other, what will get done by when. And it's made us more alive. Like, it's just, our marriage, you know, it's improved a lot of things. And it's easy to tell, by the way, when we get out of that, every time, so if I'm getting busy with stuff or vice versa, we can both kind of sense that from each other. So it's had a pretty profound, personal impact on, you know, the other big one that's just related to the marriage stuff is like just listening. Like, I realized, man, I was a terrible listener. Because I grew up, like, I did speech and debate in high school. I grew up in a household where you were just debating and arguing all the time. Not in a mean way, just like that was the way we communicated with each other. And for her, that was, you know, she would tell me a problem. She would tell me something going on. And I was like, point number one, do this. Point number two, do this. And like, you know, she never felt heard, obviously. And just learning how to sit down, listen, reflect a little bit of that back to her. That was like another huge personal change. And then on the kids' side, like we started getting into the conscious parenting thing, which is interesting. And one of the funniest, most interesting things, like, I don't know how much you've studied or if you have kids, Danny, but they say, you know, kid, obviously the general learning and framing is that kids, you're there to raise your kids. You're there to improve them and help them grow. That's your job as a parent. And the conscious parenting, like, it does lots of things. It flips that paradigm and says, what if your kids are here to teach you that there's all these parts of you that haven't grown and haven't healed? And it's not easy always to relate to it that way. And by the way, it doesn't mean you don't also raise your kids. It just means that there's interesting data and information to learn about yourself. And I've used that in a really, really powerful way to kind of, you know, notice when something really triggers me, or notice when I, you know, what types of things upset me and why, and then actually go in and go, why is that bothering me so much? What's going on there? Like, what's why? And it's actually funny if you notice it if you're thinking this way. Because totally different things trigger me than trigger my wife. Like, she gets really triggered by loudness in our house. Doesn't bother me one bit. So if the kids are loud, that doesn't matter to me. If the kids are, you know, but it really bothers her. So there's something there for her, right? And in my case, like, I get really triggered if the kids like give up on something. She doesn't really notice, right? Like it's like, what's going on with me that I have such a weird reaction to that, or I have such a, you know, a reaction to that. So it's definitely flown into all aspects.
You mentioned with you notice, or you're doing a better job at noticing when you fall away from being present. What are the signs that you see when you are not being present?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's become like a happy meal-ish of sorts. I mean, one for me is definitely, my time, you know, today's a good example. Like I tend to be less on time. I start running 10 minutes late pretty regularly, 10, 15, 20, you know, getting home late. You know, one obvious like telltale sign, if you do this stuff long enough, is like anytime you're blaming someone, the situation, yourself, like it's just a telltale sign that you've fallen out of sort of being present, and you're just like trying to find reasons for why things are happening instead of just, you know, doing it inwards. For my wife and I, it's like our connection becomes, it's just very clear. We're just like, we're less affectionate with each other. We're just like less, we're not talking as much, or our talking all becomes, you know, procedural, like, oh, when are you picking up this person? There's just nothing, there's no banter, there's no discussion. So there's like very, you know, again, very specific signs. And again, interestingly enough, like when you just do the behaviors, typically it can snap you out of it. If we just promise or make a commitment to hug each other every day and embrace really for like a minute, or not even a minute, 20 seconds, like that can make all this, you stop, the blame doesn't matter anymore. None of it, you know, you're just like, okay, we're here, we're good.
Yeah, it's so crazy how quick you can really snap out of it, and how quick we snapped out of it when you were late. It was just like, we're back in the present moment then, because you took that time, which is such a beautiful thing. I'd love to go to your why and when you discovered your why, which you've said is to help others grow / be their best selves through entrepreneurial business. When did you discover that along your journey?
Yeah, it was probably a couple years in. I can remember exactly where I was, which is interesting. I was like in my little office in San Francisco in the back of our building, and I had made this like lounge thing. So I didn't actually have an office. I have a conference room and a lounge, because I didn't, you know, the desk. I just had the conference room, and I was sitting on the chairs there. And the thing that really made it click for me was there was a few really profound things that came through, and mostly stuff from Dave. You know, one thing he mentioned, which I tell a lot of people now, is oftentimes, unsurprisingly, as humans, we make purpose. We go below the line. We make purpose, finding purpose, a threatening experience, because we say like, what is my purpose? Oh, I need a purpose. I must have a purpose. Why don't I have a purpose? Like, and one day I'm going to cure polio like Bill Gates. And like, okay, now I'm going to earn a lot of money to go do that. Like, we make it another thing that we have to go get, and another brass ring. And then we generally relate to it from a fear-based place. We don't relate to it from a, you know, and his point was like, whatever your purpose is, it's actually a form of being. It's just being who you are. And so like your purpose is not a thing you go get. It's already with you. And then, so that was the first kind of part of it. The second part of it was, by the way, you probably demonstrate your purpose on a regular basis, and you probably live it in different ways that come up all the time. You just haven't kind of put your finger on it just yet. And so then any question he asked me, which was really powerful, was like, what's the one thing you can't not do?
So good.
What just shows up when you show up? What's like the stench you bring into the room? Like, you walk in, and it's kind of an exercise. We ended up doing it with our leadership team too, but it's like, what's the one thing you can't not do? And the exercise is that you write that down, and then you kind of just like hold it near you, and you check it every few weeks, and you go, does this feel right? Or does this, and sometimes people do it, and it may take them 6 months of repeating that exercise a few times to find it. In my case, I sort of thought about it. And you know, I'd gotten feedback through the years in the business, like, man, when Jesse's in the room, like, you want to sit up straighter, you want to be on your A game. Like, he really helps you kind of level up in that way. You know, I always walk away from him feeling inspired. Like, I'd heard feedback, But coincidentally, that weekend I had been at one of my high school best friend's bachelor parties. And literally what happened during that time, totally organically, was people would take me on a walk and tell me about what was going on in their business or career. And they would like get advice from me. And they're like, oh, Pooji, like, I'm so glad, dude. Like, you helped me soup up my business now. Like, and part of that, like tying that is like, it sort of just hit me. I said, you know, the one thing I can't not do is try to help others through like help them learn and grow and be better. And business and entrepreneurship is the canvas around that. And so I kind of said some version of that. I said, I like to help people be at their best and whatever that means. And I think the conduit for me is business and entrepreneurship. And I wrote it down and it really started to kind of grow inside of me. I felt it being like a very real thing for me. And then it's like, now it's become a good touchstone for me, which is kind of like, by the way, I'd be surprised if I spend 50% of my time in that context. So I'm still, you know, it's still a work in progress, but it's a touchstone for like, if I see if something goes wrong in the business, you know, numbers don't look great, losing a customer, whatever the different things that I do in business. And they're not like, I'm like, wait, is that how I'm relating to this? Am I relating through the lens of my purpose? Like, oh no, I'm not. And like, okay, well, what would it look like if I was? And it just become a touchstone for me to use as a way to kind of be more powerful and be more present. And the other thing, you know, the other thing, just to finish the story of Dave and just doing this, sort of uncovered that. And he's like, so what do you do in the morning, Jesse? And like, what's the first thing you look at for your business? And I go, I like look at the dashboards of like the numbers, like how much money did we make? Like, how are we trending on our plan? He goes, do you think you do that from a place of that purpose or something else? And I go, oh, well, then of course I do it out of fear that it, like, something's going to go wrong or not be successful. Or I'm like, and we talked about this and I've done versions of it. It's not habitual just yet, but like, he's like, what would your to-do list look like if you lived on your purpose? He's like, oh, I'd look at my calendar. I'd see who I'm meeting that day. I'd say, how can I make that, like, help that person be the best version of themselves using business and entrepreneurship? And that would be how I'd plan and run my day. And he was like, can you just see how like powerful that might make? Like, you know, you'd be like amazing business leader if that's how you operate. And I bet you the numbers would take care of themselves in that situation. And it was a very, and has been continue again, a touchstone of a very powerful moment that I've noticed. Like, I've noticed lots of good things or lots of just positivity that's come from that orientation.
You joked before that you might not spend 50% of your time in that zone. And I'm curious what you think you could do to spend a little bit more time there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great, great question. One, and it's very like, so I was at this event this past week and, one of the cool, it was like a business conference called Capital Camp. And then, but they also had really fun events. So one of the events was meeting with like Navy SEALs who were going to teach you how to shoot and like do all this cool stuff. And so we met with this guy and he was really awesome. He opened our eyes up in a lot of different ways. One of the things he said, I wrote it down and it's kind of an answer to your question, is he was talking a lot about, and he doesn't know conscious leadership, but he knows humans and he's, you know, he knows humans in a deeper way in many ways than most of us do. And, you know, he said, he was talking about survival and things to do if someone attacks you on the street, whatever. And he goes, you know, oftentimes your ego and your reaction is like, that person can't do that to me. They can't talk to me that way. And you want to like teach them a lesson. And he was giving examples of, he's like a Navy trained sailor. He goes, I've gotten into fights with people who I thought, you know, and they'd beat me up. Like, and so he's like, so what he said, which was really interesting, is he goes like, don't forget your mission priorities. And he said, like, he's like, write your mission priorities down in the morning and review them every morning. And again, in his case, he's like, my number one mission priority is to keep my kids alive. My number two is to keep myself alive so that I can raise good kids. Like, he had these very, and he goes, in that moment, if I, like, my mission priority is to keep my kids and myself alive, like, I'm not gonna, if my ego takes over, you know, and my application of myself on that was like, oh, well, what are my mission priorities? They're to help others learn and grow. So it's like, what I actually wrote down to myself was, I actually want to start doing what he suggested, which is like, kind of every day, writing down, like, what are my mission priorities and just reviewing them, like, in, along with my journal, like my little journal I'll write every morning, just also spending a minute just going, oh yeah, that's what's important. Like, I'm literally reminding myself in the same way, kind of the index card thing. That's what's important today. Okay, I'm gonna show up that way today. And I think, again, left to sort of my natural survival instincts, you know, looking at dashboards, looking at numbers, reacting to that, firing off messages to people. Why does this look like this? And it's just a very different way of being, with like limited results. I think there are some results, but again, I think they get a ceiling on them very fast.
It's so fascinating because when you write down obvious things that you know to be true, it actually makes you better, which is odd because you're like, I know that. I know my number one mission is to make my kids happy and safe. And I know my number two mission is to make myself safe. And we forget it if we don't write it down. Is there anything else that you've written down that has come true or that has helped you, even though it might be obvious?
Yeah, there was when I started Gateway X in earlier this year in January, like I spent most of the back half of last year. I transitioned out of the day-to-day of the first company I started, Ampush, moved to St. Louis, which has kind of resettled my family here. And I generally was kind of going in circles around what to do next. And a lot of it was because I was looking at it through the lens of which outcome would be more successful. Like it was a very outcome view. And I came across this quote. I don't know where I came across it, but I made it like the background of my screensaver and stuff on my computer. And I might butcher it, but it's something along the lines of we become what we want by being what we want to become every day. And so it sort of took away this, like, I was like, oh, I want to be this like business leader who's like, I'm a billionaire. I have all these holdings. I have all these smart people working for me. And I'm like, and I kept being like, how do I solve for that? How do I solve for that? How do I get that? And that was not, and then it was like, oh no, like whatever I want to be, I'm going to show up like that every day. So we become what we want to be by being what we want to become. And so it really was a good kickstart. It put me in the gear around the new thing I started, which was like, okay, like I'm just going to show up tomorrow and I'm going to do the things that, like, I'm going to be the person that I think I could become one day. How would that person run meetings? How would that person recruit people? How would that person inspire? How would that, you know, and it's felt very reinforcing. So that's been another good this year's quote.
In previous versions of my own life, I've done things because I wanted to be someone else. I want to be this person, so I'm going to take those actions. I want to be that person. But when I started to go inward and listen to myself, I started to do things. And then it didn't matter who was the person that I was trying to be. Does that resonate or make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think it's you become yourself, right? And it's also like, I think there's a liberation for me, at least again in this year. Like I was going through the more specifics were like, oh, maybe people tell me I should start a venture fund and be this entrepreneurial investor guy. And then other people tell me I should just pick one business idea and try to run. And I want to do this kind of like venture studio incubator thing. And when I just liberated myself by being like, you know what? Like, I don't know if this will be successful. Like, I really don't. But it's kind of the thing I want to be every day. It's kind of what I want to try to do. And then it, like, you know, like, as you said, it's led me down a bunch of interesting paths. And I've stopped caring as much if it will be successful.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So take me through why you decided to start up on Twitter and spread your voice on Twitter. I assume it had something to do with your why and your purpose, but what was the reasoning behind, I'm going to start building a following or connecting with individuals on Twitter?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was like in the list of ways I could, a lot of what I'm doing now, I've designed somewhat sort of work backwards. Even the idea of launching a venture studio was somewhat rooted in this idea of like, what could be the job that would let me live my why the most, you know, the most frequently? And like, and to take it a little bit deeper, like my zones of genius, or at least the ones I feel like I've identified so far are, you know, I love this, like the first 6 to 12 months of like spotting an opportunity. Like I actually love the first week, frankly, of just like, oh my God, I have an idea and opportunity. What are all the pieces that would take to get that to work and put together? But like generally the first 6 to 12 months, I if you want to see me stay up all night doing something, that's the thing I would stay up all night doing, right? The second one is coaching and teaching people. Like I love like if I wasn't an entrepreneur, I'd probably be a professor. Hopefully I'll still be some kind of a professor one day. But like I really love that moment. I was a TA in college. Like it's a place I keep going back to. And then like I love relationships in the sense of like, I like deals actually, and the reason I like deals is because it's crazy to me that two random people can meet each other and find a way to create a lot of value together. Like that I find to be really cool. And I feel like the amount of learning that happens is really compelling. And so those three things, right, it's like ideation, teaching, relationships. I was like, what platform would let me do that, you know, and the most? And I was like, well, Venture Studio, or like something that involves starting things and hiring, you know, coaching and teaching people. And so I designed backwards from there and said, that's kind of what I want to be doing. And I want to live that way. And then, you know, the Twitter thing, I think, was kind of the spiritual side of it, was like more of a question, which is like, I wonder if there's any value in what I'm, you know, like, could I share my value? Is there a way to share that? And could I inspire people that way? I have a particular penchant for bootstrapping, just because it's like, I don't know, I've always thought it was interesting and a cool way of doing things. And I think it's like a mindset that a lot of people benefit from. It's not as in the lexicon as I wish it were relative to venture. And I have no problem with venture. I just want both of them there. And then I also, you know, generally speaking, for like, for talent, for building, for, you know, commercial opportunities, for deals, like I said, there was a more tactical side of it. The less spirit was like, this could bring me great people and great opportunities. And so the, you know, it's kind of that whole, that was the reasoning behind it. And I said, let's give it a shot and let's try it.
Was there anyone who pushed you to do it, or do you just kind of say, this looks cool?
Yeah, there was a bunch of people, like, you know, Patrick O'Shaughnessy obviously knows a lot about it. He's like, oh, it's a great tool. It's a great way to connect with people. You love people. A couple other friends had suggested, like, I was under leveraging, you know, I did a ton of public speaking in high school and other places, and I'm, you know, a good storyteller. They're like, you're just under leveraging this talent of yours, this genius of yours. Get it out there and start doing stuff with it. You know, the podcasting thing, like I thought it was just a cool way of learning. It's like a 3 or 4-fer, right? It's like, I'm learning a lot. It's getting my name out there. I'm meeting cool people. Like, it's just hitting a lot of those things. So that's been I had a lot of people who encouraged me it was an under leveraged part of me.
And one of the stories you shared on Twitter was about calling Mark Zuckerberg, and I can't have you here on this podcast without talking about that. So how did you call Mark Zuckerberg, and explain that story?
Yeah. Part of the funny thing about that story is, like, if you put it in the context of when it was, it doesn't seem that crazy. It just seems crazy because he became Mark Zuckerberg. Cause in 2005, he was just some kid. He was some junior at Harvard, and I was a junior at Penn. It wasn't like a, but yeah, the short version of it is, like, you know, Facebook was in, you know, 10 colleges or 20 colleges. We were very entrepreneurial, and we were like, let's start a high school version of Facebook. And this kid, you know, we were like, unoriginal. We're like, what should we call it? Let's call it HS Facebook. And so we find who owns hsfacebook.com. We went on Who Is or whatever. And it was some other kid who was the same age as us at Columbia. And he was like, oh, I want 20 grand for it. We're like, we don't have 20 grand. You know, we're college kids. We're like, don't worry about it. So we called the business thehighlist.com. And it was actually cool. We built the whole thing. We launched it. We started to see all the same trends of virality. And we built it in a summer, like, while having day jobs. It was a crazy summer. And we get to the end of the summer, and he pings us and goes, Mark Zuckerberg wants to buy HS Facebook. Apparently they're launching in high schools. And I mean, now that I look back on it, tons of fear. Like, the next 2 days we were paralyzed because we were like, oh my God, this thing we've been working on is not going to work. And we just got into this mode of, like, we have to figure out if it's true. Like, what if the guy is just BSing us to get us to buy his domain? And so we were, you know, like, why don't you tell us, you know, tell us, his, like, prove it. And he forwards us an email from him. And it's an email from Mark Zuckerberg with Mark Zuckerberg's cell number. And we forwarded, we see that and we go, okay, well, that seems pretty credible, but, like, we have to talk to him. We have to make sure that, and we have to, maybe his plan is different and it's not competitive with ours or whatever. And so then, like, just, you know, I'm one of those types where I'm, like, not afraid to pick up the phone. Actually, I did telemarketing in high school, which is a great, great skill set of just, like, I'm not afraid to pick up the phone and call someone. So it was a 917. I know that was the area code. I don't remember the rest of the number, but I should have kept it, but it was 917, something, something, something. And he picks up the phone. Hello. And I'm like, hey, Mark, like, you know, and I wasn't totally clear about who I was, but I was like, hey, I'm, like, looking at this domain, or, like, I'm associated with this domain. Are you guys buying this? Are you going into high schools? And I just like sat silent for the next 45 minutes while he kind of outlined their whole strategy and many, like, most of what they did for the next 10 years. Like, we're going to start with high school. We're going to go to high schools and workplaces. then locations, and like, this is how we think we can build it. It's like, he just went through the whole thing. But yeah, that was, the summer of 05.
What were the lessons you took from that story in general and about Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah. I mean, like the biggest story was, or the biggest lesson for it was like, we sort of threw in the towel after that. And I think there was like another company called My Yearbook. There was a few, like, people had success with it. And we sort of, you know, I think we let the fear overwhelm us. We sort of just threw in the towel and said, fuck it, let's go find jobs. And I think, like, if I could go back and talk to myself at that time, I said, hey, you built something. You've done something very real. Like, find a way to turn it into something more interesting, or create your own version of what you want to build. Or, like, maybe we could have talked to him and, like, I don't know, if I was him and these three kids who were my age were like, hey, we built something already, maybe he would have hired us. I don't know. Like, we didn't take it anywhere from there in any meaningful way. And so, our reaction to like the adversity was left something to be desired. Let's put it that way.
That makes sense. And it's a difficult position to be in. So I would love to talk about just advice for someone pursuing their highest version, and whether that be mentally, physically, spiritually. I'm curious, based on all this time you've gone inward, all this time you've evaluated yourself, and I'm curious if you have any insights on someone pursuing their highest version, advice for that person.
Yeah. I think that, like, I probably have a bunch of stuff. I mean, I think, like, don't be afraid to articulate what you really want, like, today and in 10 years. And I used to be afraid of saying stuff like I want to make money and I want to be this. And there's certain things I was like, oh, I shouldn't say that. And I was like, no, just say what you really want. Like, be as true to yourself as you can with what you want to go pursue. And don't, you know, and that kind of leads to the second one, which is like, man, be kind to yourself. Like, just stop judging yourself. Stop having, like, just be nice to yourself and compassionate with yourself. Because, like, it's not a, you know, I had a funny moment last summer, this is worth a quick story, which was like, I just found myself a little bit frustrated consistently for a period of a few weeks. And was talking to my coach, and he's like, did you think you were going to do this work for a few years and then just be like a perfect conscious? And I was like, and he asked me that. And in that moment, I was like, yeah, I did. Like, he nailed it. I was like, oh, I thought that I would do this for a few years and I'm like, good to go. Right. Like, I learned how to play tennis now and I can play tennis. And it was like, the work is sort of continual. It's a daily thing. And so I think getting used to that, like being kind to yourself and just being patient with yourself as you go through life and you make those mistakes and kind of go through it. And the third one would be like, you know, do your best to set aside time for some form of regular reflection. Because I think, you know, it just helps a lot of those ways, like build the habits in for that stuff. You know, the more you feel a feeling, the more curious you get about why you may be feeling that feeling. When you get really mad about something or really sad about something, just like really get curious as to what might be behind that. Yeah, those are probably some of the ones that come off the top of my head.
So beautifully said. And this is an episode and conversation that I'm personally going to revisit so I can take some notes. Thank you, Jesse, for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. And where can people connect with you further?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter's as great as anything. So my DMs are open, like, follow there. I try my best to either interact and be helpful. Most of the time, it's tough for me always to get on a call because of my schedule and stuff, but I try my best. And in general, like, I think some of the threads I've written up, and I'll probably throw up a website with some of the threads now because they're getting lost in the Twitter stuff, but like the upper limit problem thread and some of these other things that I feel like are good resources that have made some of the things I've done and learned a little bit more approachable than picking up a book or going to a seminar or something like that, which is oftentimes the way, you know, people feel like they have to go do that.
Yeah. And the upper limit problem we'll link below, because that is such a great idea that people should have in their head. So thank you, Jesse, for taking their time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Danny. It was great to meet.
I mean, the love and light that you hear from Jesse Pucci's voice is so palpable. And so I'm grateful for him for this episode and conversation. If you enjoyed it and you made it to this point in the episode, one, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Two, it would mean the absolute world to me if you just took 1 second to think about one person who you believe would enjoy this episode as well and pass it along to them. You made it to point minute 51 in this podcast, so may as well share it. And if you do, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I will see you guys in the next one. Peace.